encourage you to get your Old Testament and turn to the book of Genesis. We're going to be looking at the case of Joseph tonight, the story about Joseph. And I want to start at chapter 37 and give a little introduction to Joseph, and then we're going to talk about a particular event in his life. In chapter 37, we are introduced in verse 2 and verse 3 as Joseph as being the favored son of his father. And the text tells us that he loved Joseph more than all his children. And so we're introduced to him as that favorite son of Jacob. Well, in chapter 37, we also have the story of how his brothers sold him to Midianite traders. Verse 11 said they envied him. Verse 18 said they would have killed him. But then they decided to sell him, according to verse 28, and they sold him to Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Well, we come on down, and the Midianites then, chapter 37 and verse 36, the Midianites had sold him to Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, and a captain of the guard. So the Midianites took him on to Egypt, and they sold him to Potiphar in Egypt. Now let's jump over to chapter 39, where we'll spend the rest of our time in our study this evening. Chapter 39, we see that he rose in power, and he brought blessing to Potiphar's household. Beginning at verse 1, the text says that Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites and had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. He made him overseer of his house and put all that he had in his hand. Now, that's enough to tell us that indeed that as he went down to Egypt, and Potiphar now has him in his possession and under his control, and he begins to see the Lord blesses him, and consequently he's blessing Potiphar. And therefore he recognizes the hand of God is with Joseph. And so Joseph is being blessed, and Potiphar is being blessed because of Joseph. But the rest of the chapter now, beginning at verse 7 to the end of the chapter, is the story of how Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him. So I want to spend our time tonight talking about the seduction of Joseph. How Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him, and his reaction to that. So I want us to take time to read, beginning at verse 7, down to the end of the chapter now. Let's read that, and then we'll build our story around that reading. Beginning at verse 7. Now it came to pass that after these things, that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, lie with me. But he refused, and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and has committed all that he has into my hand. And there is no one greater in the house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? So it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time that Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by the garment, saying, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. And so it was that when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of the house, of her house, and spoke to them, saying, see, he has brought in to us a Hebrew to mock us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened that when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside. So she kept the garment with her until her master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you brought into us came in to me to mock me. And so it happened as I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside. And so it was when the master heard the words, which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, his anger was aroused. Then Joseph's master took him and put him in the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were with him in the prison. Whatever he did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hands, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Now what we have here is the story of the seduction of Joseph. And there are three things I want us to focus on in our study tonight. I want you to notice that she seduced him. But the text also tells me that he resisted her. And it also tells me some results that came as from that were quite clear. So let's talk about those three things in our study tonight. I want you to begin by noticing that the temptation was strong. That is, Joseph was tempted and the temptation was strong. And I want to try to describe to you how strong the temptation was. The temptation was strong when you realize his youth. Let's go back to chapter 37 in verse 2 just for a moment. Joseph was 17 years old before his brother sold him into Egypt, the text tells us. So when we come over now to chapter 46, chapter 41, and in verse 1 of chapter 41, that he spent 2 full years in prison. So down to verse 46 of chapter 41, and I learned that he was 30 years old when he came out of prison. So that tells me that he was somewhere between the ages of 18 and 28, somewhere in that age bracket, when all of the events that we read about in chapter 39 unfolded. Now, when I consider the fact that he was in that age bracket of that kind of youth, somewhere between 18 and 28, that tells me that his temptation was strong. Because there are desires that are strong in youth. Paul told young Timothy, flee youthful lust. There are some lusts that are peculiar to those that are in their youth. Here is a man that is in the prime for that, somewhere between 18 and 28. Here was a time when perhaps the desire would have been the strongest. You remember the Apostle Paul writing in 1 Corinthians 7, and in verse 9, that he said, concerning those that they, about marrying, it is better to marry than to burn with desire. And so here's the time when that may have been in its keenest. Now I want to say something else about that, that I learned a very practical thing. I learned from this that there are some young people that have faith and have principle. Quite often we're ready to sell our young people out and say that young people are not interested in spiritual things. They don't have the faith and the principle of those who are older. Here's a young man in his youth that had faith and he had principle that we're going to see develop in just a few moments. But his temptation was strong. You say, why do you say it's strong? Because you consider his youth at the time. But that's not all. His temptation was strong when I recognized that she solicited him. It was not he seducing her. Quite often it's the young man who seduces the young woman. And he is the one that is interested in pursuing that. But that's not the case here. I want you to notice that she solicited him. Look at verse 7. Verse 7 says she cast longing eyes on him. In other words, according to the New American Standard Version, she looked with desire at Joseph. She looked with desire at Joseph. The Living Bible paraphrase translates that, she began making eyes at Joseph. When you realize from the book of Proverbs, chapter 6 and in verse 25, when the text warns concerning chapters 5, 6, and 7, by the way, go together as a unit of chapters, warning against the harlot. The chapter 6 and verse 25 says, nor let her lure you with her eyelids. You know what that tells me? That tells me she can say more with her eyes than she can with her tongue. She can say more than 1,000 words could say just by the glance and the look of her eyes. This text says that she began to solicit him, and she made longing eyes at him. Or it may mean, as some have suggested, that she set her eye on him. But some suggest it doesn't mean that necessarily she was making eyes, though that may have been true, but that she was setting her eye to target him. He's the man that I want, and I'm going to break him down, and I'll break his resistance until he crumbled before me. And maybe that was the case. In either case, I want to suggest to you that she was soliciting him. That tells me the temptation was strong. Here's a third thing that tells me that the temptation was strong. And that is the fact that she told him how far she was willing to go. I want you to notice in this case that she was not toying, nor was she flirting, only to turn out to be a tease. That not happen quite often. Or maybe it's some young man, or maybe it's some young girl. She begins to flirt, she begins to toy, she begins to tease, and then he begins to think, this is how far it's going to go, and she says, oh no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not interested in doing that at all. Not the case here. I want you to notice that she said in verse 7, come lie with me. She said, here's how far I'm willing to go. And I want to suggest to you there were very few young men in Egypt that could have resisted that with all the ungodliness. Jude finds out Egypt's everything very few young men in Egypt. It could have said no to Potiphar's wife when she says, come lie with me. Here's how far I'm willing to go. I'm willing to go all the way with you if you're willing. That tells me, friend, the temptation was strong, or it was strong. Look how young he was. Look at the fact that she's coming on to him. And look at the fact that she's saying, here's how far I'm willing to go. But that's not all. I'm trying to describe to you that the temptation was strong. And it was strong because of the repetition of it. I want to suggest that, resistance, the first instance, is not all that hard is with anything. But when there is a strong temptation to say, no, I'm not going to do that, that's not hard to do. But when that temptation comes on again and again and again, it may get harder to say no. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. Do you remember the case of Eve? She resisted it first in Genesis 3, didn't she? But then she yielded. The first resistance isn't all that hard. Let me give you another example of that. Remember the case of Samson and Delilah? Samson resisted Delilah first, Judges 16, didn't he? Didn't he say no? Didn't he say no? Didn't he say no? And then he finally came to the pressure. And what I'm trying to describe to you is the repetition of that pressure. Makes that temptation even stronger. I want you to notice what verse 10 says. Back to Genesis chapter 39. And so it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her. This wasn't just a one-time thing that he came by her and he saw her pass through the hallway and she said, hey, if you're interested. And he says no and she leaves him alone. But day after day after day after day, she began to beg him and began to plead with him and began to flirt with him and make eyes with him. And I want to tell you, that resistance, that temptation was strong. She said, how do you know it's strong? Look how young he was. Look at the fact she's coming on to him. And she said, here's how far I'm willing to go. Now, from the standpoint of Satan, I want to turn with you to Proverbs 6. I said those three chapters, 5, 6, and 7, go together as a unit. Dealing with the question of the harlot. Chapter 6 says, from the vantage point of Satan, that's designed to wear him down. For by means of a harlot, a man is reduced to a crust of bread, and adulteress will prey upon his precious life. She can't do that with one occasion. She can't do that on two occasions. But day after day, she begins to wear away a little bit of resistance and wear away at his strength, wear away at his morals, until finally maybe she can crumble him like a crust of bread. That's the divine effect. It was a strong temptation, but that's not all. I want to suggest to you the temptation was strong when I consider that there was a convenient opportunity for them. You say, how so? Well, let's consider. I want you to notice the fact that one could easily be caught in any sin served as a deterrent, doesn't it? Well, if you sent to the stealing, you realize cameras are all around going to capture my picture stealing this, then I better not do that. The opportunity is not all that convenient. When others are standing around and they may see, well, that serves as a deterrent for the sin, but that's not the case. You look at verse 11. Verse 11 of Genesis 39 said the master was gone and no one else was around in the house. The opportunity is right. The opportunity is there. You get the picture. He's young. Passion runs high. She's coming on to him. She said, here's how far I'm willing to go if you're ever willing. She keeps on and she keeps on and she keeps on, and then at least on this occasion, no one else is around, and the master's not around, and no one else is in the house. But Joseph is there. And the opportunity is right. Now let's go back to Proverbs for a moment. Let's go back to the book of Proverbs chapter 7. I want to suggest to you that being alone with no one else can be quite enticing. The picture of Proverbs chapters 5, 6, and 7, now this time we're going to the 7th chapter. Pictures of harlot coming running out for the young man and trying her best to seduce him. And notice her appeal in verses 19 and 20. For my husband is not at home, she said. Well, first of all, back up to verse 18, she really builds his ego by saying, I came out to diligently seek you and I found your face. There's no one else but you. You're the only one I'm interested in. I wouldn't do this with anybody else. He's lying through her teeth, by the way. Verse 19. For my husband is not at home. He's gone on a long journey. No one's around. We won't get caught. Wait. How do you know he won't come in? How do you know he won't find us? How do you know he's not about to come home? Look at verse 20. He's taking a bag of money with him and taking some home for the appointed day. He's not supposed to be back for 2 weeks. There's a traveler's check with him after all. He's not coming back. He's going to be gone. We won't get caught. You see, being alone becomes quite enticing. And I learned a very practical thing about that, and that is there is a danger of being alone when no one else is around with the opposite sex. That's dangerous for a young person, young man or young woman. That's dangerous for preachers. To be alone when no one else is around with the opposite sex. Because it becomes quite enticing. Now, what I've got to picture for you is how strong the temptation was. What made it strong? Consider his youth, how young he was. When temptation is at its strongest, consider she solicited him, and she said, this is what I'm willing to do. And she told him that over and begged and begged, and now the opportunity is right. Oh, there are very few men that can say no to that. But as equally as that was strong, I want to suggest to you that his resistance was firm. And that's the story and the beauty of Genesis chapter 39. So let's go back to chapter 39, and I want us to begin at verse 8 now. And let's talk about his resistance was firm. How did he resist? Well, the first thing I want you to notice, he resisted with words. And there are several things I want you to notice. First of all, he said, no, I'm not going to do that. Look at verse 8. Genesis 39 and verse 8. The text said, when she came to Joseph, cast longing eyes at verse 7, and said, lie with me, but he, you might underline, refused. He said, no. No. Look at verse 10. So it was that as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her. He resisted with words. What did he say? He said, no, I'm not going to do it. She said, here's how far I'm willing to go. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. That's not all he said. He said something else. He resisted with words and he spoke of trust. Look at verse 8. He not only just said, no, I'm not interested, but he had somewhat to say to her. Look at verse 8. But he refused and he said to his master's wife, look, my master does not want know what is with me in the house. And he said, he committed all that he has into my hand. My master trusts me, and I do not want to betray that trust. I'm going to tell you, your parents trust you. Your husband trusts you. Your wife trusts you. He spoke of trust. He said, no, I don't do those kind of things. Secondly, someone trusts me. But that's not all he said. There's a third thing he said. I want you to notice as he spoke, and he resisted with words, he recalled the sacredness of marriage. Look at verse 9. In verse 9 he said, there is no one greater in the house than I. He kept back nothing from me but you. Because you are his wife. In other words, Potiphar allowed me to have anything I want. I can touch anything he has. I can use anything he has but you. And that's because you're his wife. You're off limits. You're a married woman. So he recalled the sacredness of marriage. He resisted with words by saying, no, someone trusts me, and you're a married woman. But that's not all he said. Consider further. He called it in verse 9 wickedness or evil. Or in other words, it's immoral. He said, how can I do this great wickedness? That's what he said to her. Wasn't just thinking that. He said to her, how can I do this great wickedness? He didn't just say, no, I don't do those kind of things. Well, I wasn't raised that way. I think we ought to wait a little while. He said, this is wickedness. It's evil, it's immoral. And that's why I can't do that. Well, that's not all he said. I want you to notice, first of all, he said it is a sin against God. How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? In other words, the sin is not just a sin, because it's not just the fact that you're a married woman. It's not because I might be breaking up a marriage. That's not all that's wrong with it. It's not because we'd be violating marriage vows, or it's not because you'd be untrue but unfaithful to your husband. It's because of your sin and wickedness against God. That's what makes you wrong. That's what makes you wrong. I want you to notice how strong he was in resisting with words. He didn't just say a little bit. He said, no, my master, trust me. You're a married woman. It would be evil and wicked and immoral, and it is against God. I'm quite a bit straight about it, isn't it? That's not the only way he resisted. He furthermore resisted with deeds, put his money where his mouth was. It's one thing to talk of your deeds, but then you need to put your actions with your words. And he resisted with deeds. How so? I want you to notice that he refused to be with her. Look at verse 10. Something that we sometimes perhaps miss in our study of Genesis 39 and verse 10. The third one, he spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her, now you might underline in your Bible, or to be with her. How do you resist the deeds? He refused to be with her. The International translates that, or even be with her. Did you get to the point? He didn't just say, no, I'm not going to commit fornication with you. But he didn't even want to be with her. Didn't even want to be around her. Because he saw a danger in that. He refused to lie with her, or even to be with her. The Living Bible paraphrase said, he kept out of her way as much as possible. He's trying to avoid it. He understood the danger of association. He well understood that if you hang around and continue to hang around, you could easily let this lead into something it ought not to lead into. Here's a tempting circumstance. Here's a tempting situation. Here is someone that may be an allurement to you. You hang around and you begin to hang around and you begin to talk to them and become more familiar. That's increasing the chances that the sin is going to be committed. And he recognized that. He understood another principle here. And that is from Proverbs 5 and verse 8. We've been going to Proverbs 5 and 6. Back to the 6 and 7 and of course the 5th chapter. One of the other three chapters that goes together with that. Chapter 5 and in verse 8. Remember the warning to the young man how to avoid the harlot? He said, do not go near the door of her house. Remove your way far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. She's tempting. She may allure you. She may invite you. She may entice you. So you stay clear of as far as possible. Don't go by her house to see she's there. Don't go by her house to see she's at home. You go far from her. Do not go near the door of her house. If she's at work, don't go by her cubicle. Don't go by her office. Don't do that. Don't go near her. He resisted with deeds by saying, I refuse to even be with her. But that's not the only thing he did with deeds. He resisted with deeds by refusing to be with her. And then verse 12 says, he fled and he ran outside. Notice that in verse 12. Genesis 39, now and in verse 12. The text says, that she caught him by the garment, and she said, lie with me, but he left the garment in her hand, and he fled, and he ran outside. I want to suggest to you, that meant literally. I don't mean that he just kind of, in principle, and in mind, left her, he literally ran outside. He fled, and he ran outside. He removed himself from the tempting circumstance. And the tempting situation. His actions showed that his words were real. Now, a moment ago, when he resisted with work, he was saying things like, no, you're a married woman. You're a master. Trust me. This would be evil and immoral and a sin against God. Now, he shows he means business. He shows he means business because he fled and he ran outside. And she is reaching for her embrace him. I want to suggest to you, that may mean sometimes, young person, that may mean you'll have to leave a house, maybe a car, or a bedroom, or a living room, or a couch, and take off and run somewhere else. Wouldn't that be better to be embarrassed a little bit and have to call somebody to come and get you? I got out of the car, and I ran, and I called you to come and get me, than have to acknowledge that I've committed the sin of fornication, and I've sinned before God. and now I have sin in my life. Would that be fun? You might have to leave somewhere, house or car. Here's something else about his resistance. He resisted with words. He resisted with deeds. But I want to suggest to you that verse 8 and verse 12 said he resisted promptly. Verse 8 said, but he refused. Verse 12 said he fled and ran outside. That tells me he resisted without the slightest hesitation. He did it without dilly-dallying around with the temptation. He wasn't waiting to see how far this may go. Can you see somebody doing that today? I don't know if she really means this or not. I just don't know if she's going to go as far as she says. Let me just see how far she's going to go. Let's just see how far it gets before I have to get up and leave. He didn't do that. He resisted properly. But that's not all. He furthermore resisted firmly, verses 8 through 10. He did so without wavering. He did so without indecision and without hesitation. There was no pushing aside something he secretly desired. There is no indication that he was saying, no, I shouldn't do this, but in his mind he's thinking, well, I sure would like to. And the chance is offered to me again, I might do it, but if she keeps asking, I might, but I'm going to tell her right, no right now. No pushing aside something he secretly desired. He said no, and he meant no. And he fled, and he ran outside. What I'm trying to describe to you is the resistance was firm. The temptation was strong, but the resistance was equally as firm. How so? He resisted with words. Remember what he said? He said, no. He said, my master, trust me. He said, you're a married woman. This would be wicked. This was sin against God. He resisted by deeds, by not even being with her and then fleeing and running outside. He resisted promptly. He resisted firmly. But thirdly, I want to suggest to you, the temptation was strong. The resistance was firm. And then the result was clear. So what do you mean the result was clear? Well, when Joseph finally got outside, remember he fled right outside verse 12? When he finally got out on the outside, Joseph can look back and he can see with greater clarity three things like he's never seen before. I don't know how he saw it beforehand, all of it. But he can see with greater clarity some things now that he's never seen before. How so? Well, I'll tell you what he can see. He can look back and he can see now the difference between love and lust, can he not? He can see the difference in love and lust. There's a big difference in love and lust. This woman lusted for him, but she did not love him. He said, how do you know she didn't love him? Let's just see in the context. Here's the evidence thereof. Do you remember her lying about him? Look at verse 14. She was the one reaching for him saying, come lie with me. Not just one occasion, but numerous occasions she had done that, according to verse 10. And then in verse 14, that when he fled and ran outside, you know what she did? She called the men who were out in the hallway to come in, and she took the garment. Look what this Hebrew has done to us. He came in here to mock me. Let me paraphrase that where you understand. She's saying, he came in here tried to rape me. And I cried, and I hollered out, and I yelled, and if it hadn't been for that, he probably would have done it, but he ran away, and I've got his garment here. She lied about it. Then her husband comes in. She checks that garment. She shows it to him. That Hebrew that you brought in came in. He tried to rape me. And he would have if I hadn't cried out. And she allowed her husband to put him in prison. And what that tells me, she didn't like him. She had made every effort to destroy him. Pulpit well said. But indeed, all illicit passion, whether gratified or bought, has a tendency sooner or later to be transformed into hate. Isn't that true? Isn't that true? Whatever love she seems to have had for him is all now turned to hatred. She did not love him. She lusted for him. One who lusts after you does not necessarily love you. Listen to me, young person. When someone talks about, oh, how I love you. I love you. If you love me, you'll do this too. And we'll do this if we love one another. Oh, they don't love you. They're lusting at you. And that's not the same thing. That's not the same thing. I want to suggest to you that love seeks gratification. Love cares about the person. She didn't care about Joseph at all. And Joseph didn't see that before. Now that he's on the outside, he can look back and he can say, I now know the difference between love and lust. I now know the difference. I know exactly the difference. But that's not all he could see. Joseph can look back and he can see some things he lost. He left some things in there. He ran out pretty quick, didn't he? And at least he looked behind some things. He can look back and say, you know what, I've lost some things. Here's some first thing he lost. Oh. Good. Left in her hand. He doesn't have that anymore. That's not so bad. Say something else he lost. Verse 20 says he lost his job. Remember that? He had a pretty important job, didn't he? Pretty much anything Potiphar had was at his disposal. Verse 20, put in prison. He's not working anymore. He's no longer the main man under Potiphar. He's lost his freedom, verse 20. He's cast into prison. That's not all he's lost. He's lost his standing and his approval among men. Because he's lying to these men saying, look what he tried to do to me. I don't know how much they believe that, but whatever degree that they believe that, he's lost his reputation among those people. That's a lot to lose, isn't it? He's lost his coat, he's lost his job, he's lost his freedom. I want to suggest to you, you may lose some things and you're standing for your purity. And you may look back and you may say, you know what, I lost my boyfriend over that, I lost my girlfriend over that, and I've lost my friends over that. There's not a one of those things that Joseph lost that he couldn't live without. He can make it without his freedom. He can make it without the coat. He can make it without a job, and he did. You may lose some people over that. You may lose some friendships. You may lose some people who put a little pressure on you because you're not going along with the crowd and doing what they do. Everybody else is doing. He looks back and can see the things that he lost. But that's not all. Finally, I want you to notice. If Joseph gets out on the outside and he can look back and he can think about the things he brought with him. Now, have you thought about what he took with him? He took some things with him, you know. He left that garment back over there and left his job over there and left his freedom over there. But he took some things out with him. And he looked with greater clarity. I tell you what he brought with him. He brought his purity with him. He didn't need it over there. Joseph still was a pure man. And that's not all he brought with him. He brought his honor with him. Then look at verse 6. We're just in chapter 5, 6, and 7. Chapter 6 and verse 33 talks about the man who yields to the harlot. Wounds and dishonor will he get. Not Joseph. He brought his honor with him. He gave that over. See, what else he brought out with him? He brought his conscience with him. His conscience wouldn't allow him to do it. His conscience was pure. And he's still here. He's not eaten alive with guilt now. He brought that with him. There's something else he brought out with him. He brought his reputation among the godly. I don't know about all these men that heard the report about you. He tried to rape me. I don't know who all believed that. And there may have been a number of people changed their mind about Joseph and thought, oh, what a terrible man he is. But I tell you what, he's got quite a reputation among the godly. You say, what do you find that? We're talking about him tonight, aren't we? He's a godly, noble example. You know how in my book is yours? Quite a reputation. He brought it out with him. Say something else. His relationship with God. Now let's close by looking at verses 20. 1 to 25. You remember after he's put in prison, trying to stand us, he brought his relationship to God. He brought that out with him. He had a good relationship with God, and when he came outside, he still has that. Brought it with him. He said, how do you know? After he's cast into prison, remember what happened when he's put in prison? How the keeper of the prison put all that he had into Joseph's hands? Verse 23, the keeper of the prison did not look into anything but into Joseph's hands because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made it to the Lord still has that. Joseph can look to greater clarity. And he sees three things like he's never seen before. He sees the difference in love and lust. He can see the things are left behind. Don't leave them anymore. But I brought the important things with me. He sees every bit of that. The resistance was firm, and now the results are clear. Now, when you want the body preach on a subject matter like this, check out that there's probably not a person present, if we were conducting this as a Bible class, including the young people, if we were to go around, did you already know fornication was sinful? Did you already know it was wrong and that you shouldn't do that? Every single person would have to say, I've known that quite well for a long time. So what value is it a preach on? The sin of fornication. What value is it? See, I've studied that a number of years ago. Several years ago, there was a survey made among colleges and universities across the land about the percentage of the students that committed premarital relationships. I don't know what the number was, but it was significantly high. The percentage of students that committed fornication. Well, that wasn't surprising. So some of the people connected with the so-called, and I put in quotations, church schools among brethren like Three Hardeman and David Lipscomb and Harding and those colleges did a similar survey. And they found the number of committing fornication was significantly lower. So they decided they would do a study of why is that the case? Why is it that you're not committing fornication like the rest of the world is in the other universities? And a number of answers came back. Some said it was because of Bible class teachers and their influence. Others said it was their parents' instructions. Others said it was the peers that they had and the friends that they had. Others said they were afraid of pregnancy. Others were afraid of venereal disease. Number one answer, surprising. Pulpit preaching and teaching on the subject. That's interesting to me. And if we could spare one life from a sermon like this, one soul from being stained, if some young person cannot remember Brother Rager's name, but I remember somewhere up in Virginia, I heard a sermon one time from some old preacher somewhere that said, and it sticks in their mind, our time has been well spent tonight. It's been well spent. There may be one or more present. He's not a Christian. He's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins and acknowledge your faith in Christ and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject anyway, would you come all together? We stand and sing.